Yesterday was the first yard site of Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and I felt it was fitting, as I see a lot of shuls organizations are doing around the world, to speak a little bit about him, really, and to learn him through his Torah. Not going to give much of a biography, but it's important to know that Rabbi Sachs, born in 1948, was born to a family that did not have much Jewish education. His father, he mentioned numerous times, did not have much Jewish education. He was the first in his family to attend college, and obviously became the chief rabbi in 1991. And Rabbi Sachs really was an ambassador of Torah through his teachings, through his writings and his presentations, and really what he stood for. And that he stood for, and he stood up for many things, for values and for ethical norms. He stood against anti-Semitism. He called out BDS. He could also say things in a way, because of who he was and how he presented and how he carried himself, that he could say things that might appear, if somebody else said them, as very frum, so to speak. But because he was so genuine, what it meant personally for him to be a committed, dedicated, thoughtful, sincere, caring, growing religious Jew, that there are certain, you know, ways that he talks and essays that he has that are very mustery in a certain way, but because it was all come from a very genuine place of religious growth. And, you know, if you're looking to read some of Rabbi Sachs, obviously so many publications. You can go back to one of his original earlier ones called The Letter in the Scroll, which really where he talks about his personal journey. I highly, highly recommend it. And obviously his topics on the Parsha, his books on morality, and just there's so much. So I thought it would be an opportunity for us to learn Rabbi Sachs through the Parsha, through what he has to say. Just on this speaking, you could pick many weeks to do this on. That's the beauty of Rabbi Sachs. But I chose a few ideas that I think really speak to the themes that Rabbi Sachs comes back to, throughout the different times. So we'll start at the beginning of the Parsha. We know that in this week's Parsha, Avraham is very, very busy. Sarah has died at the age of 137, and yet he buys a burial plot for Sarah. He negotiates the deal of the century, to buy Marisa Machpelah. Then he finds a wife for Yitzchak. At the end of the parasha, he once again remarries, has more children. And the Torah tells us, Avraham Zokein Babayam, Hashem Berach es Avraham Bakol. Right? Hashem blessed Avraham with everything. And yet you then find that he's very busy. Usually you would think that if the Torah says such and such a person had everything, the next pasuk should be, and they sat on the beach and they relaxed and it was a great rest of their life. This is one of the busiest parshios for Avram. There is no longer Sarah to be there to be his guide, and he has to go through and do a number of these things. And in fact, at the end of the parsha, you actually see that he's learned from Sarah, because at the end, he kicks everybody else out of the house. He gives them a lot of food and money and wealth, but he says he can't be around Yitzchak, which in last week's parsha, when Sarah tells him to do that, Avram says, no way. I'm not going to kick out Yishmael. So that's throughout this parsha. So Rabbi Sachs discusses, what does this mean that he is blessed, Hashem birachas Avraham bakol, and yet is very busy, a wife for Yitzchak, and continuing this legacy. So he says the following idea. He says that throughout the story of Avraham and Sarah, we know that there are two things that they are promised: children and the land. In fact, I will tell you that Rabbi Sachs, and as a I believe in a presentation to the OU in 1994, you might be able to find it online, Rabbi Sachs actually says that there are three promises in the beginning of Lech Lecha. One is, I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to give you the land. And then he says there's a third. But for most of Jewish history, we couldn't even get the two. We were kicked out of this land and that land and persecuted and expelled, and we didn't have a homeland and we didn't have enough people. He says, but in the last 50 years, 60, 70 years, all right, so we have a land now. Since 1948, we finally have a land once again. We have rebuilt ourselves after the Shoah. So he says, the third bracha is, v'nivrechu b'cha kol mishpachos ha'adama. That the real goal is that through us, people should be blessed. We should be a beacon of light, living life the proper way, teaching, educating the world. And that's the promise that we're up to. But either way, in this week's parasha, we know that there are two things: children and a land. over and over and over again, this promise of land, this promise of children comes up over again. And despite all of this, when Sarah dies in the beginning of the parasha, let's think about this. What does he have? He doesn't really have land because he has to buy it back. And he doesn't really have a lot of people. He has Yitzchak, and Yitzchak stayed at the mountain. So all of these promises that he has heard over again, and I'm going to give you land. We spoke about this last week, that the Avos live in real time. They don't live in a fantasy world. They live in real, that's what Emunah means. So after all of this, he has one child, is not married, and he doesn't have land. And that's what you have, says Rabbi Sacks. The Torah slows down, he writes, the speed of this narrative. Because God promises, but we have to act. God says, Abraham, I promise you the land, but you got to buy the field. I'll give you descendants, but you have to marry off Yitzchak. And to a woman who's going to share in that legacy, in that journey, in that mission. So says Rabbi Sacks, despite all the promises, God does not and will not do it alone. By very act of self-limitation, through which Hashem created space for human freedom, he gives us responsibility. This is a major, major theme in Rabbi Sacks, that we have a responsibility to act and to do things. And he notices that there's a difference between Noach in the beginning and Avram. That after Noach was given that responsibility, he failed. He got drunk. He didn't want to rebuild that world. It was too much in front of him. Avram is the opposite. So why does this narrative slow down? It's because God, yes, of course he makes those promises. And it's specifically after all of these promises that now Avram gets to work. And this is an idea that as Jews, it is our responsibility. What changes the world, he says, is not what fulfills our destiny, is not what God does for us, but what we do for God. And I'll just share for a minute or two that Rabbi Sacks once shared that really this idea, this self-growth, constantly thinking and growing, is the story of himself. Rabbi Sacks spoke a number of years ago at the Kinnas Shluchim for Chabad, and all the thousands of Chabad Shluchim get together. And he told a remarkable, remarkable story. And I won't tell you the whole story because it's a longer story. But the story of Rabbi Sacks is that he credits a lot of where he is in his life, or where he was at that point in his growth and what he did in becoming the chief rabbi, to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He says it was 1968. He was a second-year student at Cambridge. And he had met a number of rabbanim, and they suggested, go in the summer, go to America, and meet the great rabbanim, meet Rabbi Soloveitchik, and go around. So he came the summer of 1968 to meet the great rabbis. And everywhere that they stopped him, everybody said to him, if you're here to see great rabbis, you got to go see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Okay? So what does he do? He packs up, he goes across to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he goes to Eastern Parkway, goes to 770. He sees the first chassid, and he says to some chassid, hey, I want to go speak to the Rebbe. What do I do? The guy says, it doesn't work like that. He's just going to walk right on in. So he says, thousands of people are waiting to see the Rebbe. Forget about it. So Rabbi Sacks says, okay, I'm going to travel around America. Here's my phone number. I'm with my aunt in L.A. If it works, call me. Weeks later, Rabbi Sacks tells the story. Weeks later, he's in Los Angeles. Motzei Shabbos, the phone rings from Chabad. The Rebbe will see you on Thursday. Okay? He says, I don't have any money. I got a Greyhound bus ticket. I traveled by bus 72 hours. I sat on the bus. He says, I come to 770 in the middle of, I'm ushered into the Rebbe's study. I ask him all the questions. He says, and then the Rebbe puts it back on Rabbi Sacks. He says to Rabbi Sacks, how many Jewish students are in Cambridge? That's what he asked him. I don't know. I have no idea. He's like, I don't know. I'm a student there. So he's asking more and more questions. And Rabbi Sacks says, in the situation which I find myself, the Rebbe stops him and says, nobody finds themselves in a situation. You put yourself in a situation. If you put yourself in one situation, put yourself in another situation. And Rabbi Sacks goes on to say that this story ends with the following. He was supposed to go back to England. He had a flight At the end of August, it was supposed to go back. So the day before in Shabbos, he goes to the Fibrengen at Chabad. And they tell him, oh, you're going back. Yeah, go say a lechayim with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he goes in the middle of Fibrengen. He goes to reach his glass to take a lechayim with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And Lubavitcher says, you're going? He says, yeah, I'm going. He says, why are you going? He says, I have to get back to Cambridge. Lubavitcher Rebbe says, Cambridge doesn't begin until October. Says Rabbi Sachs, I have no idea until this day how he knew that Cambridge started in October. But he was right. So I stayed in Rosh Hashanah, and I heard him blow the shofar for the Rebbe, and it left that it impacted him. And he writes further, Rabbi Sachs, that this story, he came back again. He eventually gets married. Then he starts teaching philosophy. He writes a doctorate. He studied. He qualified as a rabbi, but he didn't really know what to do. So he went again to see the rabbi. He says to the rabbi, I have three choices in front of me. I could become an academic, right? Maybe I'll be a professor. I could, I could be an economist, or I could be like an advocate. So he goes to ask the rabbi what to do. And the rabbi says, you got to train rabbis. That's your job. So how can I train rabbis? I don't even know what to do. So he goes ahead and he learns, and because he trains the rabbi, and then he's all of a sudden up for this job for chief rabbi in 1990. He becomes chief rabbi in 1991. So once again, he says, I sat down with my wife, Elaine, with my children, and they agreed that I could go ask the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So the story ends like this. So he goes to the rabbi, and the rabbi, he writes a letter to the rabbi, the pros and the cons. And he wrote the following. If they offer me the job, should I accept? ? The Rebbe's reply was the following. He says, it's a reverse word order. Instead of saying, should I? The answer is, I should. That's all the Rebbe wrote back. Not, if I get the job, should I accept it? It's, if I get the job, I should accept it. And that was it. And this is a young man who went to meet the Rebbe once, who had an encounter that he admits did not change his life forever. But he goes again, and he talks again. And all of that led him to become the chief rabbi in 1991 and become the Rabbi Sachs who we know. This is Avraham. Avraham doesn't stop. Avraham never gets to a point in which Avraham says, you know what? I've lived a long enough good life. I've had a lot of things. I'm going to retire. Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old. But it's not only that at a certain point we just keep moving. It's that we're constantly reinvigorating ourselves and pushing ourselves towards new goals. No matter where we are in our lives, it is all about making sure we continue to work for God. The more that I put God and Yiddishkeit in front of me, the better off we are going to be. And that's idea number one, an idea that comes up over and over again. Idea number two is a fascinating idea that, again, has themes throughout much of Rabbi Sachs' writings and presentations. And that is right in the beginning. Avraham hears about the death of Sarah. And according to the Medrash, we know that death most likely came because of the event of the Akedah. So the Pasuk tells us that Avram comes vayavo, in the middle of the Pasuk, it says vayavo Avram, the spolus sarav alivkasa. Avram, he mourns and he eulogizes and he gives a hespid and he's crying. And the very, very next words are vayakam Avram. The very next words, after he mourns, you know, we often, when we sit with Avelim, we tell them, take it 1 hour at a time, one day at a time. Don't rush into anything. Don't take it. This is Shiva. This is Shloshin. This is Yud Beis Chodesh. Here it is. The moment after his hesped, he closed the sitter, Vayakam Avram, and he goes and he makes the arrangement for Maris HaMachpela, and he finds a wife for Yitzchak, and then he remarries. What is this connection between these psukim? And Rabbi Sachs says it bothered him. It bothered him. That Avram, you know, he's moving. And he writes that Avram does not wait for God to act. He understood one of the most profound truths of Judaism, that God is waiting for us to act, like we just said earlier. But here Rabbi Sachs shares a deeper insight. How do we as Jewish people deal with grief? When we are overcome with tragedies and terrible things that happen in our lives, how do we deal with that? So the Torah has different things where we can't over excessively mourn, but how do we put our practice into grief? Rabbi Soloveitchik often would remark in the Pasuk in Tehillim, Keli Keli Lama Zaftani, that it's about what do I do? How do I put something into being? That how do I respond with action? And says Rabbi Sachs, what gave Avram this resilience, this ability to survive, was something that Rabbi Sacks says he learned from his greatest mentors in moral courage, the Holocaust survivors. Just today in school, we started the Names Not Numbers a project, one of the most crucial projects that students, especially as we go later in years, and the surviving generation every year becomes a little bit less, that we get a chance to meet survivors, interview survivors. So Rabbi Sacks says he wondered, how did they deal? What happened? And he says that the survivors had a tenacious hold on life. So he wanted to know what kept them going. And he writes that eventually I discovered most of them did not talk about the past, even to their marriage partners, even to their children. Instead, they set about creating a new life in a new land. They found work. Rabbi Sacks says that here you have like Noach and Avraham. Noach looks back and he's so overcome with grief that he can't do anything. Avraham, on the other hand, it wants to build. The survivors, they built. They came to this country. They came to Israel. They came to wherever. And they built. They built Torah institutions and batei midrashim and kolalim and chesed organizations and day school systems and shuls. And they built. That is how they grieved. And that, says Rabbi Sacks, is what Avraham does. He's not being callous. He's not being like, oh, I give Aspen. I got something else to deal with today. Avraham is overcome with grief, but he knows I'm going to put that grief into action. So he rebuilds and he remarries and he finds a way for Yitzchak and he perpetuates a legacy of his generations of B'nai Yisrael, which is us, that is created in that vacuum of his grief. And I'll share something that you won't find in the writings of Rabbi Sacks. A friend of mine told me that Rabbi Sacks, when he was in Boca Raton, my good friend is Rabbi Phil Moskowitz, who's the associate rabbi of Boca Raton Synagogue. And they had a Q&A with Rabbi Sacks a number of years ago. If you ever had the chance to hear Rabbi Sacks speak live, it's his command, obviously, of the English language was, in a different stratosphere. But his genuineness when he spoke was very, very sincere. So he had a Q&A. And somebody asked him, Rabbi Sacks, could you give me your top five moments in Jewish history? And that sounds like a good, like, Rabbi Sacks kind of question. Like, what are your top five moments? So he responded by saying that I don't know that I have, top five, but the criteria for defining moments in Jewish history is that any time that Jews were defeated or seemed defeated, knocked down, beaten up, persecuted, kicked around, somehow we didn't just regroup, but we produced something new into our world. And then he explained the following. Look at history. It's an amazing insight. Look at history. Yeah, the destruction of the first base of Mingdash. The world is in disarray. How are we going to continue? What do we get after that? Torah Shebaal Peh, Mishnah, Gemara, a way to pass down a Mesorah from one way to the next. Yes, it was terrible. We were grieving, but we knew we had to rebuild. So we built it with Torah Shebaal Peh, with a system in place that we still have today to be part of Mesorah. Then you have the destruction of the second base of Mingdash. We lost the home of God. We're crying to Rabbi Akiva at the Seder table. How are we going to go on? They're crying to him. Oh my gosh, there's foxes running out from the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash. And what do we develop? Tefillah. So we might not have karbanos. We might not have the opportunities to see the Kohen Gadol, to have the Avodah, do all these things. But I can open a Seder and I can talk to God. And I don't need to go to the Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Akiva tells us, you could talk directly to the Ribono Sholem. So was it terrible that we lost the Beis HaMikdash? Of course. But we created something new. After the Crusades decimated the Rhineland, the European Rhineland in 1096, we have the Baalei Tosfos, a whole generation that were able to teach us Torah. After the Spanish Inquisition, we produced the Kabbalists in Tzfat. And even, he says, after the Shoah, a horror that we cannot begin to explain. We have a state of Israel. We have an explosion of Torah learning that has been unprecedented in Jewish history. So says Rabbi Sacks, I don't know my top five moments, but if you look at history, every time that we've somehow been dealt with something terrible, we've created something positive. Now, I always think, we say every day in davening, Matobu Alecha Yaakov. So we know that Matobu Alecha Yaakov is obviously not said by a Jew, it's said by Bilam. Why would it be that we would use in our davening a Russia's that would try to curse the Jews? We use it. If I try to introduce a text this Shabbos, this week we're going to read from Ahmadinejad and, you know, Bashar al-Assad and a little Saddam Hussein. It's going to be beautiful. We would obviously not say those things. And in fact, there were certain Achronim that said, take it out. But Rabbi Lamb once said that that's actually why we leave it in. He says, we turned the malediction into a benediction. What you thought was bad, we made it into a bracha. So says Rabbi Sachs, you think that all these moments were bad, they were, but look what we produced. That's how Jews grieve. We rebuild, we work harder, we try harder, we find something new. That's what survivors did. Survivors came to this country and they rebuilt it. We would be nowhere without the survivors in that generation. So that's Rabbi Sachs, another major theme that personal involvement that I feel. And I'll tell one of my favorite quotes of Rabbi Sachs. Rabbi Sachs, in his book, Optimism to Hope, he writes that faith doesn't mean living with certainty. Faith is the courage to live with uncertainty, knowing that God is with us on that tough but necessary journey to a world that honors life and treasures peace. This is what it means to live with Emunah. To live with Emunah means I'm going to rebuild. Things were terrible, but I'm going to keep going and I'm going to keep growing. And that's idea number two. It's in this piece also that Rabbi Sachs quotes often from Viktor Frankl. Now, Viktor Frankl and his Man's Search for Meaning, this is exactly what he describes, that he taught about hearing a future calling for people. Okay. So those are two more ideas connected to my relationship with Hashem, the goal that I have. And I would add to this point, you know, in the beginning of this year, in my eighth grade class, I teach Hilchos Shabbos. It was one of the things that we learned in eighth grade. And one of the first articles that I have my students read is actually an article by Rabbi Sachs. You can find it online. It's an article on YU Torah that he wrote for Torah to Go a number of years ago on Pesach. And his point in that article is that Judaism is a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And we thought that if we made it easier in Jewish history, more people would join. So we relax on kashrus, on taras ha-mishpacha, and on Shabbos, in the hopes that more people would join. And it's the opposite has been true. They don't want to join. That we have to put the effort in and the work in if we want our Judaism to be meaningful and to be important. So those are two major, you know, more global ideas in terms of our relationship with Hashem, how Emunah works. But I want to now focus on another major theme, and that is Chesed. Chesed, civility, humanity was obviously a major, major recurring theme of Rabbi Sachs, which is why he was so well respected in so many circles, because this is a theme that applies to the whole world. But he shares the following story. Shares the following story from Stephen Carter. Stephen Carter, who went to Yale and became a best-selling novelist, a writer. So he tells the following story. He says, Stephen Carter, 1966. Stephen Carter is an 11-year-old African-American boy. He moves from a white neighborhood in Washington. He's sitting with his brothers and sisters on the front step of the house, and he wants to see, how are people going to greet me? That's what he wants to see. So this is a phenomenal story. So they, and he's, lo and behold, they were not greeting him. They either, you know, didn't look at him, or they looked but didn't smile, or they even, you know, gave him a nasty look. And all the fearful stories that he had heard about how the whites treated blacks were coming true. Years later, when he writes about those first days, he says, I knew we were not welcome here, that we weren't going to be liked, that no, we're not going to have friends, that we should have never moved here. And this is what this Stephen Carter is thinking, an 11-year-old boy sitting on his step. He says, as I'm thinking this, a woman passes by. She turns to the kids. She says, welcome. She goes into her house. She emerges later with a tray of drinks, cream cheese and jelly sandwiches, which she brought for the kids to make them feel at home. And he says, that moment changed his life. It gave him a sense of belonging where there was none before, that people, that race relations were still fraught. But if a black family could feel at home in a white area, there could be relationships maybe we'll all be colorblind. And over the years, he learned to admire this woman across the street, that what that spontaneous act of greeting them really changed his life. He credits, he became a law professor. He wrote a book called Civility. And in this book, Civility, he tells us the name of this woman, Sarah Kestenbaum. She was a religious Jew. And in the book, Civility, he writes the following. In Jewish tradition, he notes such civility is called chesed. Well, chesed, but chesed. The doing of acts of kindness, which in turn is derived from the understanding that human beings are made b'tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. Civility itself may be seen as part of chesed. It does indeed require kindness towards the citizens. And he says, to this day, I can close my eyes and feel on my tongue the smooth, the slick sweetness of the cream cheese and jelly sandwiches that I gobble on that summer afternoon. I discovered how a single act of genuine and unassuming civility can change a life forever. This is a theme of chesed. We obviously see this in this week's parsha. When Yitzchak needs a wife, Avram tells Eliezer, gotta go find a wife. Eliezer says, the only litmus test that I will use is chesed. Not gonna, obviously she's gotta be from a good, you know, she's gotta have other criteria. But the litmus test, let's see how she does chesed. And if you look at the psukim, and you take the psukim from this week's parsha, and you see the chesed that is done in the home of Avram and Sarah, it's similar languages. She is very giving. It's hers before, it's theirs before hers. The camels, she is the scope of her chesed, how she does chesed. Chesed, as I mentioned last Friday in our WhatsApp group, chesed is an art. It is not simply that I just can do it, but that I do it in a certain way, that I'm kind and considerate, and I look out for the person I'm, it's not about me, it's about the person that I'm doing it for. And this is obviously the theme. There's the Arbein Adam the Chaver was based on chesed. And I often think, and if you read Rabbi Sacks, this is a point that we've shared numerous times. I think sometimes the word chesed gets a bad rap. When we hear the word chesed, we immediately think of someone less than, less money, less space, less food, less clothes. And I will do said chesed. And that is an absolute part of chesed. But chesed is everything. I could do chesed for my family. I could do chesed for my best friend. Chesed is in how I approach another person with civility, with humanity, with caring and kindness. It is not only that I just drop a package off of food at someone's house, but I call to check in, that I reach out to people. I make sure that someone who might have been home for a while gets a phone call. That's all part of chesed. And those are really three major, major ideas of Rabbi Sacks in this week's parsha. One is this sense of Avraham feeling very busy in this week's parsha. Even though God bless him, he knows that he has to be involved. If he wants those promises, he has to be involved in that process. And that's also why he feels that as you look in the psukim, Avraham grieves by doing, by being involved and by being engaged and by pushing himself to do all of these things, because that's how we as Jewish people grieve. And that's his life story. This meetings with the Lubavitcher Rebbe and how he came to be who he was he constantly, read the letter in the scroll, he is constantly reevaluating his life. He was a model of what it means to live as a lifelong learner, always pushing, always new goals, new challenges, taking advantage of new opportunities. And to sum all of this up, and obviously this idea of chesed, which is a major, major theme of his writings throughout, the civility that we show towards one another. So I'll just end with a story that he told, but I think ties us all together. And he says he heard this story from a shaliach. He says a Chabad shaliach had gone to a little town in Alaska. And he asked the local town hall. He says, are there any Jews here? So he said, there's no Jews. We don't have any Jews. So he asked, listen, can I go visit the local school? I'll give a talk to the kids. So whatever, fine, go ahead, go to the school. So he goes to the school and he goes in and he says, any of you ever met a Jew? So a girl puts up her hand and goes, yeah, I met a Jew once. Great. Who did you meet? I met my mother. My mother's a Jew. All right. So we had two Jews now, her mother and her. And the Chabad Shaliach tells the story to Rabbi Sacks, and he says, what do I say to this girl? She's the only Jewish child that's left in this school, the only Jews in the entire city. I have to leave. What am I going to share? What can I say to this little girl? And he says, this is what I told her. He asked her that every Erev Shabbos, I want you to light candles. And he told the girl, I don't know if you know this, but Alaska is the most westerly place in the world where there are Jews. It is the last place in the world where Shabbos comes in. When they start Shabbos in Alaska, they're already Shabbos in America, and Shabbos already, it's ice Shabbos in Australia. This is it. So when every Jew lights Shabbos candles, they bring light and peace into the world. And every Shabbos, the whole world is waiting for your Shabbos candle, because you will be the last one to light the Shabbos candles. So Rabbi Sacks says, imagine what it did for that child. Imagine. Could have said anything. Right? He could have told her, what are you doing here? There's no Jews. But he made her feel important. He made her feel that she had a task to perform for the whole Jewish people, how we can change lives. Rabbi Sacks, if anything, was not just an amazing ambassador to Torah, whose teachings and writings will live on forever and it will continue to inspire many generations of people to learn Torah. But if anything, Rabbi Sacks and his writings and what he stood for is empowering to us. He shares with us the secret that we are able to accomplish all of these things, that God speaks to man, that man can speak to God, that man can do great things for Hashem. As long as we believe in Hashem, we believe in ourselves and our capabilities and our abilities. And every time that we feel that sense of empowerment, that is really what Rabbi Sacks is trying to convey to us and to share with us. So obviously all the